You're listening to World Oil Deep Dive, conversations with energy industry leaders and engineers about the market trends and technologies shaping the oil and gas industry. Now, here's this week's episode.
Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of World Oil Deep Dive. And we're very fortunate this week to have with us Molly Detterman and Tim Tarpley from the Energy Workforce Technology Council. Welcome to the show, guys.
Thanks for having us.
Glad to be here.
Hey, before we get started, I always like, you know, our listeners and viewers to have a bit about your background and how you came to be in this position at EWTC. So, Molly, let's start with you, ladies. First, give us a little bit of your background and tell us how you came to be president.
Sure. So my background is in public relations and nonprofit management, and I started doing some PR consulting in oilfield services. So from there, when I got brought on to the Energy Workforce and Technology Council, it was really kind of the perfect combination of bringing together the nonprofit management experience that I had and, you know, getting more into the oilfield services sector of the industry that I like started learning about and just really found it really fascinating. So I've been with the organization for 11 years and, you know, have grown obviously, you know, from, you know, starting out in PR to taking on our programs and events and, you know, our marketing and membership and all of those things, and have just kind of grown that way with the organization over that time period.
Wow, that's an interesting background and seems like a purpose fit for this type of organization, right? You got both sides of it. So
absolutely.
Yeah, that's awesome. Tim, how about yourself?
Yeah, so I have a policy background. I'm a lawyer by training. I was right out of law school. I was hired by former Congressman Mac Thornberry to be his legislative counsel. He originally hired me to handle the Military Commissions Act, which was during the war on terror. And he wanted somebody that kind of had a constitutional background that could help write that legislation. Stayed with him for 4 years, picked up healthcare, picked up energy issues after a while. Then I was hired from his office to be legislative director for Congressman Poe, who was actually my home district congressman. You know, used to represent 2nd District of Texas, which is actually the district that Crenshaw has now. Was hired by him originally as his legislative director and then worked my way up to be his chief of staff. Stayed with him for about 10 years. He was senior on foreign affairs and judiciary and did a lot of energy issues as well, obviously given his district and the representation he covered. And through his foreign affairs work, he had jurisdiction over international pipelines, so got involved in a lot of, you know, the oil export issue and LNG exports and crude oil exports, Keystone Pipeline permitting through his work on foreign affairs. So had a lot of good policy experience over that time on the Hill. And then I was hired at Energy Workforce about 6 years ago to build out their government affairs work. So I've been here for since then. And then, was originally hired by the former CEO, Leslie Beyer, about 6 years ago.
Wow. That's an impressive resume, and interestingly, a completely different skill set than Molly has, right? So that's a... You know, I mean,
we're a good team.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's interesting because you're both presidents, and now I understand exactly why that is, because you need all of those skills. It must be impossible to come up with somebody who's got the legislative experience and the oil field experience and the, you know, communications experience. That would be like some kind of unicorn. So together, you guys make one unicorn. That's awesome.
I love it. We're a unicorn for sure.
You guys can argue.
We got to say that one, Molly. We'll use that. We'll use that in the future.
You guys can argue about who's the head and who's the tail of the unicorn later. Okay. So, but hey, so tell us. You know, this is interesting because this happened under Leslie before, right? There was a joining of associations, and the name was changed to the unwieldy EWTC, which now doesn't seem so unwieldy, does it? I mean, it does kind of roll off the tongue these days. We've been saying it long enough. So tell us about the work that the Energy Workforce Technology Council does for its members and for the industry at large.
Yeah. Maybe we'll divide that up. So I'll talk a little bit about some of it, and Tim can talk about the other. But energy workforce, we are the National Trade Association for Energy Services and Equipment Companies. So everything that we do is around best practice sharing, benchmarking, and advocacy, then also providing networking opportunities. So one of the things, that I think is distinctive about us as a trade association is that we have a lot of leadership development and workforce development programs that we developed. We're in our ninth year of those programs and have continued to grow those programs every year and expanded that, and has really been a good resource for not only our members, but also our operator customers utilize those as well. And then in the benchmarking and best practice sharing area, it's always about, what are the current issues that our member companies are facing and how can we help them come together collectively to address those? Tim, you want to talk about the advocacy and all?
Yeah. And, as I mentioned, was hired on to really build out a national government affairs presence for the organization, and we truly have done that. We are focused on not only federal issues but state issues in the states where our members have active operations, which is quite a few. We focus on all issues that affect our members. We advocate, both in front of Congress, in front of the administration, all of the relevant agencies, State Department, Department of Energy, Department of Commerce, wow, as well as all the state agencies and state government officials that in our relevant states. So, we're very active. We also lead, one of the things that I've spent a lot of time working on is we lead a coalition of multiple trade associations, that cover both the operators and offshore. And we work together on advocacy issues. There's going to be issues where the service companies have a particular view and we want to advocate on our own and we want to have our own discussions. And that's great. And we do that. But there's also issues where we all want to work together. We want to work together with our operator friends and we all want to be rowing the boat down the same path. So for issues like energy access, things like the LNG pause that the administration just laid out, those are issues where we all agree and we're all fighting the same fight. So we coordinate, we work together. Every Monday we get together and talk about what's going on, and then more importantly is we share information amongst ourselves, which is very important. But probably more importantly than that, we coordinate on advocacy efforts. We put together joint letters, put together joint advocacy strategies. We'll go meet with members together as a unified front. We'll get requests from committees that will say, hey, what is your coalition think? And we're able to work together and put together those responses. So that's something that I think has been really successful, is building that coalition out.
Yeah. So Tim, just to follow up on that real quick then. So I imagine that your experience with, politicians and legislatures and how that works, do they come to the EWTC because they know you're experts? Like if there's some question about a law or they're thinking about doing something, will they come and say, hey, man, can you, tell us more about this because we don't know?
That's a great question. And it goes both ways. The key to advocacy and having successful government affairs practices really to get those relationships built so that they do start coming to you. You can be effective going out and chasing down legislators and making your case to them. And that's great. And that's a big part of it. But when you really start getting successful at it, it's when they come to you and they ask you for your expertise. And that's what we've been working to build with Energy Workforce, is that we have that kind of name recognition. All that we do, the op-eds, the meetings, it's all for that goal, so that the legislators come to us. And it's working. I'm going to testify in front of House Oversight Committee on Energy Issues, the field hearing in Dallas in 2 weeks. And, the reason we're able to get into those kinds of, opportunities is really by the relationship building and the kind of back office work you do throughout the year. And then, when they're looking for somebody, they come to you, and we're able to give that voice to the sector and to our member companies.
Yeah, no, I think that's fascinating, that whole political side. The chief editor of World Law, Kurt Abraham, he worked for the magazine, left, and went and worked for a lobby firm for like 3 years in D.C. And so
really,
I don't know the details of that, but he loves that that political side of it for sure. Yeah. I mean, and it is an important side because, you know, these days, I mean, all kinds of crazy stuff's coming down the pike. I mean, it's weird. But Molly, you touched on something earlier. You were talking about working together. And I don't know if you guys have seen this as a theme. I've definitely seen this as a theme recently in some people I was talking to. And it's crazy to me that like operators and service companies seem to be like partnering up and sharing information more than they ever have in the past. I mean, you would have never had an operator saying, hey, let me show you all of this well data so that you can make your system better, Mr. Service Company, to help me out. That would have never happened in the past. Do you guys see those bonds and those relationships between operators and service companies happening more frequently?
For sure. I mean, there's certainly always going to be that certain level of push-pull that's there between the operator and their service companies. But I think that, you know, we think that it's really important to not just talk about partnership between the operators and the service companies, but actually make sure that, you know, there is a voice for the suppliers to their operators so that it's more than just, you know, we're talking about partnership, that there is an umbrella voice of the suppliers coming to the operators to talk about, you know, the way that we are impacted by different things, whether it's supply chain or legislation. These are the ways that our member companies are represented. And back to, you know, kind of that coalition, I think that that's one of the things that's really powerful. And I know, you know, the EWTC, Energy Workforce and Technology Council, you know, it did feel unwieldy at first. But we kept coming back to that name because that is who we represent and what our people do. Like that is exactly who we are. And so we have a really powerful voice and the operators recognize that because we are the boots on the ground. And, you know, we represent something different than what the other organizations represent. And we have a different story to tell. And so I think that, you know, that I'm kind of addressing both questions, but I think that, that's an important part of us as an organization.
Just to add quickly to what Molly said there, she's hit it right head on. We're 650,000 workers in the energy industry. That voice is very powerful, and the operators will often come to us and they will say, "We need to highlight that voice, those workers." And we also have workers in all 50 states. There's manufacturing, there's equipment that's built in states that may not touch oil and gas. You know, they're not producing oil and gas, but we have manufacturing there. So we collect all that. We collect all that data. We know exactly where all of our workers are, and we use that data for advocacy. And the operators will often want to work with us on an issue because they know that they can leverage, you know, that workforce that is nationwide.
Yeah. So before we get into some of the success stories, you know, of the things you've been doing for companies in the industries, explain to us a little bit about the kind of the membership structure, right? Because you're talking about operators and service companies, and I imagine there's some other people mixed in. How does that, what does that shake out like?
Sure. So our memberships are corporate, and predominantly it's our industry members. So there's different categories of membership. There's industry, allied, and industry partners, and also international members too. But predominantly industry members, and those are the service and equipment companies. Then the allied members are our consulting companies, like the investment banks, like the large consultants like Deloitte and, you know, Accenture, right. those guys that are providing industry level insights at our meetings. And then our industry partners are the operators, and they join and want to participate. And part of the reason why is because they're taking advantage of some of the workforce development programs that we have.
Right.
Yep. In addition to having that forum with which to speak to their suppliers.
Yeah, and that's a very hot topic these days, has been for, you know, even before COVID, right? You know, the workforce and training people, giving them the skills to operate, and quite frankly, just attracting them to our industry, right? I mean, that's a big question mark. How do we attract people to our industry? Although I think that's got to be getting easier, because it seems like all of the emphasis these days is on digital transformation and those type of things. And so, you know, kids who are studying programming or, you know, any of the computer skills, seems like we'd have a nice place for them in our industry these days, right?
We do have a nice place for them. And we're having to work against, though, you know, a false narrative that exists about our industry and what people understand about it. So bringing people from outside of the industry in, you know, is a challenge that we have to face. But then once we get them in, we want to be able to hang on to them. And that's exactly where that workforce development training really helps us, because we're creating and helping to sustain cultures where once we bring people in, this is a destination workplace where they want to be.
Yeah. And it used to be, correct me if I'm wrong, because I really don't know. I know that we're having a hard time finding people and keeping them. But wasn't it the case before that we just threw like a ton of money at everybody and then they came because the money was big, even though the work was hard and you had to be away from your family a lot, but the paycheck was just so big that it just attracted people.
When we don't have, and that's not our competitive advantage anymore. And so, you know, the pay isn't always that much better than other industries, but there's also a lot of people in, you know, especially in younger generations that are willing to make less money to, you know, sit in a factory on a guaranteed schedule and sit in some air conditioning. And so that we have other things that are going to keep people here.
Yeah, it's funny. I guess when I'm thinking about my kids who are grown now, 20s, you know, late 20s, early 20s, they didn't grow up with Gordon Gekko, man. So they don't understand. They don't understand the, that drive that our generation had, you know, to just be more successful monetarily. They have a whole different set of priorities these days, right? And so I find it fascinating. I really do. So tell us, give us some concrete examples. What have you guys been able to do either legislatively or, you know, for workforce training, any of that type of stuff for your members? Yeah.
Well, I think one of the things that we're really proud of is a lot of the training and best practice that we have built out over the past couple of years. Over the past 2 years, we designed and built the first in the market training for case-told well servicing. It's called SecureWell. The program kicked off earlier this year, and we're putting, you know, hundreds of students through this course, and they're getting certified in well servicing. And that was designed by experts in the field. You know, the six biggest well servicing companies in the country got together and said, we need to do better. We need to build out our own training program. We need it for our workers and for safety and to improve the work product. So they got together and we organized it and they built it out. We're doing similar things for well stimulation. Our well stimulation committee has put together a best practices document for surface operations for well stimulation. It's the first in the United States. There's a document in Canada, but here in the United States there isn't one, and we're putting it together. So we're really proud of that growth in kind of the best practices and training. We think we're going to do more of it. It's a growth area for the association, and it's great for our members, and our members will get very engaged on it.
Oh, that's fantastic. And it's kind of shocking to think that there hasn't been one like for frac, right? I mean, you'd be like, come on, man. I mean, we're doing this every day, nonstop, you know, and there's no best practices guide. Everybody just kind of makes it up on the fly. I mean, that's kind of weird, right?
And it's very smart for the industry strategically to put together these documents, because you always want to put it together as an industry first. Because if you don't, the regulators are going to come in and they're going to do it on their own, and it won't be based, you know, based on the knowledge that these companies have. For example, a lot of money was put in the bipartisan infrastructure bill for plugging of orphaned wells, right, and abandoned wells. There's a lot of states out there that didn't have real strong developed programs on how to handle orphaned wells in that state. Our well servicing committee got together and wrote a best practices document on how you actually deal with these step by step and at best practices. And we shared that with all the states that were going to receive this money So they had a framework. So they had a basic framework to build out their own rules and regulations for how to spend this money. And it was done with the industry skills with folks that had, you know, been doing this for combined hundreds of years of experience. You know, I think those examples are really where a trade association shows their value is getting the members together, getting a work product out there that otherwise wouldn't exist if you didn't have the trade association, and then sharing that with regulators, you know, that can be used for states and by other regulators to put together their own work product. And that's good for everybody. It's good for the regulations, and it's also good for the companies because they were involved in it. And they were able to craft it in a way that really shows the way the industry works. So we're excited about a lot of that work that we've been doing.
Yeah, that's amazing. And now, one of the other things I know that you guys do, like Molly, you mentioned this, about networking opportunities. And one of the biggest, best networking opportunities of the year is coming right up, right? The annual meeting?
Yeah, our annual meeting. It'll be in Scottsdale, Arizona, April 24th, 25th. And we've got a really great lineup. And one of the things that I think, you know, I'm really always pleased by is that we have a committee of our executives that come together each fall and put together the agenda for the year's conference and talk about like, what are the key themes? What are the things that we want to address and know more about? And, so they've built a great agenda with a great lineup of speakers.
That's awesome. Can you give us a sneak peek? Who's going to be there?
Yeah. So we've got keynotes on, you know, we've got our market outlook and an election outlook. We've also got an executive level overview of AI. We've got panels. We've got the ERCOT CEO coming in. And then we've got panels on onshore, offshore, new energies. We're going to be covering a lot in 2 days.
That sounds really busy. That sounds really busy, but I'm telling you, it seems like you could spend like the whole time just on politics and AI, right? I mean,
that could be
a week's worth of talks, it seems like, these days. And so tell us then, so if somebody wanted to come to the annual meeting, they have to be a member, they have to be in one of the member categories, right?
That's right. It is exclusive to our member companies, our operator executives as well.
Yeah. And so if they did want to come to Scottsdale, that's going to be fun too. I'm going to be there, right?
Yeah. So therefore you should be there.
Yeah. Yeah. They need to, can they just like sign up now and come? Cause it's like in a couple of weeks, right?
Yeah. People can still sign up and come. We'll make space.
All right, so tell us then where would they go? Where's the best place to go to get more information, to sign up and become a member?
If you go to the Energy Workforce homepage, which is energyworkforce.org, we got a big old sign up right there on the landing page. First thing you'll see is annual meeting. Register here. So you can't miss it. So go there. You can register online or it'll have contact information for us so that we can help you out if you need it.
And we're always happy now, you know, if anybody has specific questions about their company and the association, we're always happy to jump on a call and talk it through with them.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yes. And before we go, this is something I completely slipped my mind earlier, but tell people, this isn't free, so give us an idea of what it costs to be a member and how that whole thing works, because I think this is fascinating.
Yeah, so the memberships are tiered based on your previous year's revenues. So it scales based on company size, but it also changes every year, you know, based on how your company is doing. So if you've had a year where your company hasn't done well, then that automatically discounts your dues. So depending, you know, when you have a good year, then you can pay a little bit more. So it slides every single year.
That's fantastic. I don't know much about association pricing fees and whatnot, but that seems super smart because everybody's on the same page, right? Everybody wins together. Everybody suffers together. And that's the way it should be. I think in our industry, you know, so
now.
Well, thanks so much for taking the time to speak with us today. And I'm really looking forward to Scottsdale. And hopefully a lot of you listeners, viewers out there will run over and sign up for that too, because you'll be happy you did in the end, for sure. So thanks again, everybody, for tuning in this week. And don't forget to go and, you know, rate us in your favorite podcast app and all of those good things. It really does help, you know, get our word out to more people. So thanks again, Tim, Molly. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Jim.
Thanks for tuning into our show. Please check out the show notes for the links we discussed in the podcast. We value your opinions. So if you have any questions or comments, kindly email them to us at deepdive@worldoil.com. Additionally, we'd appreciate it if you could rate us on your preferred podcast listening app. Lastly, don't forget to visit worldoil.com for the latest technical articles and news about the oil and gas industry.